This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The year 2015 is coming to an end, and it has been quite a year. To take us back to some of the most profound moments of the year, we have decided to talk with our producers and take a look back at some of their favorite segments from the year. Producer Anita Rao is with me in the studio now. Anita, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What are you going to start us off with today?
So I'm going to start us off with one of the more difficult moments of 2015 here in North Carolina. Back in February, three students were shot to death in Chapel Hill. Dia Shadi Barakat, his wife Yusur Abu Salha, and Yusur's younger sister Razan. And it was a really difficult time for our community. And I remember in our newsroom and around our table, we were talking about how we wanted to best tackle this subject. How could we move the conversation forward? And I happened to check my email, and I got an email from a woman named Musarat Jabin. And Sister Jabin is the principal of Al Iman. It's an Islamic school in Raleigh. And she had actually taught both Yusur and Dia, and she had recorded a StoryCorps conversation with Yusur just the year before. So she reached out to me and said that she was wondering whether we would consider airing the conversation and whether it might be relevant to what was happening in the community now. So I dug it up, and I remember just, you know, pulling out my headphones and putting it on the speakers and sitting with both you and our senior producer listening together. And it was very moving and a really good way to sort of commemorate and memorialize these three students.
Let's listen to a little bit of that right now.
Growing up in America has been such a blessing. And, you know, although in some ways I do stand out, such as, you know, the hijab I wear on my head, the head covering, there's still so many ways that I feel so embedded in the fabric that is, you know, our culture. And
Absolutely.
That's the beautiful thing here is that it doesn't matter where you come from. There's so many different people from so many different places and of different backgrounds and religions.
Absolutely.
But here we're all one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when I see you, your friends, and other students who graduated from Al Iman School, this is the feeling we get, that how well you guys have, you know, adjusted, or I would say you just blended into the fabric, you know. Our girls, they wear their head coverings or hijab, we call it hijab, and they are, you know, at the top of their class, they are participating in everything. You should not tell me about what Al Iman has given you. How do you feel about that, and what was your experience at Al Iman?
Oh, my experience at Al Iman was an unforgettable one, and I got a wonderful education there and was able to excel in high school. And now I'm at NC State University studying human biology and looking forward to applying to dental schools.
And got married to one of my other students.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting.
I was so happy, you know, when I saw you guys together and I heard about it. I couldn't just, you know, express how I felt, you know, that these are the two kids that we taught and you will be together for the rest of your life, inshallah. Yes. And this is the pride that we take in our children, you know, their accomplishments in their lives. That's what gives us as educators a sense of accomplishment. Yeah.
So if you had the podium that you can stand on in front of the whole world and all attention was on you and there's just one thing you could tell them, what would that one thing be?
Live in peace.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would say. Because it means so much to me that today in this world, there's so much going on. And I wish that we all would learn to live in peace and harmony. The world would become such a beautiful place when we respect each other, when we, you know, we care for each other. And we have that sense of giving, sense of respect, because that's what makes this place, this world, a beautiful place, when we have that brotherhood and sisterhood.
Sister Jabin, I love hearing from you. You always have the right thing to say, you know, the right answers. Before our time is up, Sister Jabin, I'd just like to thank you, first, for giving me the opportunity to be here with you today and listen to your story and your experiences and advice.
Yes.
And it's been an honor.
No, I want to thank you, Yusur, for coming in. And, you know, this is what I was telling you while we were driving, that anytime I ask you guys for anything, You, all of my students are there for me, and the honor is mine. Thank you so much.
Of course.
That is a clip from a StoryCorps conversation between Yusor Abu Salah and her elementary school teacher, Masarat Jabin. Yusor was one of three students shot to death in Chapel Hill in February of this year, and I am here with producer Anita Rao, who chose that segment as one of her favorites from this past year. Tell us more about that, Anita.
So that conversation was recorded by StoryCorps a little less than a year before the shooting happened. But there were so many themes in that conversation that really resonated with what was happening at that time. Questions about whether or not this incident was a hate crime, questions about what it meant to be a Muslim in America right now, and most of all, sort of a great look at sort of who Yusor was as a person and the characteristics she had and sort of what she and her sister and her husband had sort of given to the community. So we felt like it was a really powerful segment and one we wanted to air. But in addition to that, we wanted to reach out to Musarat Jabin to see whether she wanted to come on the State of Things and reflect with us. And she did so. She said she was excited to come on and wanted the opportunity to talk more about these former students of hers. So she came in and we followed the StoryCorps clip with the conversation that you had with Sister Jabin.
Well, let's listen to a clip now of my conversation with Sister Jabin. I asked her why she reached out to us about the StoryCorps piece and why she thinks it's important for people to know what Yusor has to say. Let's listen.
I think it's important because I want everybody to know how Yusor, Dia, and Razan were, what values they grew up with, and what they are practicing in their lives. And I just kept thinking about it. What can I do? They are the ones who have taught me to be stronger, and I have learned to be stronger just because of their faith in who they are and what they want to contribute to the world, not just their own community. And I want to honor them, and that's the reason why I wanted to be here.
Can you tell us more about each of them as students and what you remember about them in class?
They were amazing kids, both Dia and Yusor. And they had very high expectations of themselves and would never settle down for the least. I still remember Dia one time. He was in sixth grade at that time. And one of his teachers did not give him a good grade on one of the tests. And he just came to me and crying and hugging me. And he said, "You need to do something about it. I did my best and I would not settle down for a B." And I hugged him and I said, "Dia, B is a good grade." He said, "No, it's not a good grade. And can you please talk to the teacher? Just ask her to give me another chance." And I hugged him and I said, "Dia, you just amaze me. And I don't know what I can do, but I'll try my best so that you can have a retest." And you can see that glow in his face. That, okay, I'll be given a second chance. Yusor, as a student, she was very hardworking, and she takes everything very seriously. She would do her best. She would prove herself to be a perfectionist. And that's what makes me proud of them, that they led a life where they gave so much back to their community. And in such a short period of time, they accomplished so much that people don't accomplish in their lifetime.
There has been so much media coverage in the aftermath of their deaths, and I wonder what you make of it all.
It's very hard for me to still make sense of it, like why it happened. And I'm just, you know, speechless. I can't think of anything because as far as I know, these children were very respectful kids. And to me, it's just senseless. I just don't know. I just don't have words to express my sorrow. But at the same time, I'm very happy that the whole world knows who they were and their legacy is not going to die. It's going to live forever. And today, when I woke up this morning, I thought to myself that I have learned something from them. They have made me a stronger person, and I have a greater job to do now. I have many diyas and many yusurs and many rezans to take care of. And each one of them will carry their legacy. They will continue with it. We will continue doing. As long as I live, these children will be with me.
That's a clip from my conversation with Musarat Jabin, the principal of Aliman School in Raleigh. She joined me in the days after three of her former students were shot and killed in Chapel Hill earlier this year. I'm here with producer Anita Rao talking about some of her most memorable segments of this past year. And I have to say it was a deep honor, Anita, to be able to talk with Sister Jabin and just her willingness to come in. It was a very difficult time. We wanted to make it clear to her that this was not anything that we wanted to do if she wasn't, you know, fully engaged in this and felt that it was important to her. And so for you as a producer, what was the biggest challenge in putting that together?
Yeah, I mean, I think as you said, everything was so raw. It was just days, I think 2 days after the incident had happened. It was the first time that she had listened back to that StoryCorps conversation. And so I really wanted to make sure that she had an opportunity to reflect in the way that felt most comfortable to her, given the circumstances and given how close we were to the event. So that was the careful line we were walking, was to make sure that she could talk in the way that she wanted, but we could also sort of facilitate a conversation that we would hope would resonate with a bigger audience of listeners and of people in the community that had together witnessed this pretty traumatic event.
I'm talking with Anita Rao, a producer on The State of Things, talking about her most memorable moments in the year 2015. And that conversation will continue on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, spending the hour with State of Things producer Anita Rao, looking back at the past year and talking about some of the highlights. So what's next for us?
So now we're going to talk about a show that I produced back in June that was a full hour show about body image. This show was really fun to put together, had a ton of moving parts. And it was really inspired by the fact that, you know, there's a lot of conversation about how images of women's bodies are everywhere, and we've heard a lot of people talk about the kind of impact that seeing these images has on how women and how other people think about their own body. But there was one sort of rising sector of this conversation that I felt like hadn't been talked about that much, and that was people who felt like no one was really talking about the fact that fat shaming is a huge problem, and that we need to acknowledge that fat bodies can be both healthy and beautiful, and that's a really important part of a conversation about body image. So we started the hour talking with a woman named Jessamine Stanley. She's a self-described fat femme, and she gained national prominence for her Instagram feed that documents her yoga progression. So I'd seen a number of things about Jessamine, and then something that said, you know, Jessamine's teaching a class in Durham. And I was like, what? Jessamine lives here. So that grounded it, and immediately I knew that we had to put this whole show together. So it came together in just a few days, but we were able to really dig deep into this phenomenon. So I want to play a clip now from the second part of that conversation. We were joined by a historian named Joan Jacobs Brumberg, and she has spent a lot of her career examining girls' diaries and thinking about what it means to come of age in a female body at different points in American history.
All right, let's listen to that clip.
In the 19th century, young women were primarily concerned with good works. And by the 20th century, they are nearly obsessive in the 1980s about good looks. And of course, that parallel with this is a change from an exuberance about being with their girlfriends and snacking and eating fruit and candy in the late 19th century. By the 1980s, a century later, there are diaries that have obsessive listings of everything that is eaten. There's just an awful lot of guilt and anxiety about it.
And so, and this also correlates with our perceptions of fat or body weight, body type. That has shifted over
right.
time. Talk about that change between, the 19th century and 20th century.
Well, you know, I argue that until you have mirrors and electric lights to look at yourself, your level of self-scrutiny isn't very intense. And most families in the 19th century didn't have a looking glass unless they were fairly wealthy. By the end of the 19th century, Sears and Roebuck begins to advertise little handheld mirrors so that someone you know, who is a working woman can have one at home. So the social class availability of mirrors begins to change. And in the 1920s, of course, you've got compacts, you know, little things for checking your makeup on the street. Mirrors and also scales, the ability to weigh yourself and see how much you weigh. The scale is a 20th century invention. We don't really have, we have scales, to be sure, to weigh animals and wheat,
right.
You know. But the domestic bathroom scale doesn't really enter most American homes until after World War II.
But also, you also point out that in the 19th century in particular, being overweight was, in fact, a status symbol. It was good to be heavy. And
oh,
it,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say a robust body, even what we would consider a fat body. You know, people who would fail that, you know, adipose test that we give now. This was regarded positively in two ways. It was both a sign of success in that the family had enough money for the wife and children to be well fed, and it also was a sign of health in an age when wasting diseases were very, very prevalent.
So what was happening to change the way others saw the female body? What made the larger, you know, society in general, was it men in general who like a thinner woman? What was going on there?
Well, I wouldn't blame it on men. I think it's a historical process that has to do with the changes from pre-industrial, pre-modern life to urbanization and industrialization. I know these are big historical words, but people start to live differently and they consume differently. And the technology is increasingly making forms of self-scrutiny more central to people's lives. And you can see this in girls' diaries, the way they talk about their friends, the way they talk about clothing. Standard sizing is a big thing in this story too, because, you know, before standard sizing, a seamstress could finesse what was wrong. If there was a perception that you were thick of waist or that you had a particularly long torso, all of these things could be handled in a way at home. But once you start going to a store and you have to fit into a standard sizing, there's pressure to conform to an iconic measurement.
Well, we're joined now by a woman who is trying to redefine what normal and beauty look like for women today. Brittany Gibbons is a humorist, an author, and a blogger who's best known for standing in her swimsuit in public. Here she is in a TED Talk talking about what it's like to stand in her bikini in Times Square.
I stood in my bathing suit on national television, and I thought, so this is what this feels like. I'm a little cold, kind of uncomfortable. Every single part of my body wanted me to find my pants and get the hell out of there, but I didn't. And I didn't because I wanted to show people what women in this country look like.
Humorist and blogger Brittany Gibbons, she has gone on to write a memoir about her life as a plus-sized woman. It's called Fat Girl Walking, Sex, Food, Love, and Being Comfortable in Your Own Skin, Every Inch of It. And she joins us now. Brittany Gibbons, welcome to State of Things.
Hi, thank you.
You talk a lot in your book about how terrible it is for people who are plus-sized, who are larger. Could you read a section from your book about that and kind of what it's like to feel that contempt?
Sure. People are horrible to plus-size women. Moms equate your relationship status to your BMI. Aunts make passive-aggressive comments to you about what constitutes a girlish figure. The guy in line behind you at the Chinese buffet asks you if you're especially hungry that day. People walk around with a certain level of entitlement to your body, but it's nothing compared to the internet. The internet is a special place people can go to say the extra horrible things that they're way too cowardly to say to your face. Writing online has opened me up to an entire world of negative commentary. While it is at times soul-crushing and obnoxious in a very do-you-kiss-your-mother-with-that-mouth kind of fashion, it's not entirely unexpected. But what was unexpected was who it was coming from. Other women. Men did it too, sure, but the women-on-women genocide was a complete surprise. In my personal experience, negative male commentary about my body is primarily full of superficial generalities like you're fat or you're ugly. It's important to note, however, that the majority of online response I get from men is positive. They often applaud my curves, thank me for validating the bodies of their wives and daughters, and in some cases, ask me for my phone number and relationship status. Women are a completely different monster. There is no greater species better crafted for emotional terrorism than women. We've bred them to see other successes as a direct assault to our own, and this is especially true when it comes to weight. Seeing someone who is heavier than us viewing themselves in a positive light is detrimental to our own self-esteem. So we attack and tear down until eventually that person feels as bad about herself as we do about ourselves. And for some reason, that goes in the win column. Ladies, we don't even need the fashion industry and society to do this for us. We're busy enough trying to meet the demands of doing it to each other.
Brittany Gibbons, the author of Fat Girl Walking, Sex, Food, Love, and Being Comfortable in Your Own Skin, Every Inch of It. Also with us is Joan Brumberg, who is a social historian. And Professor Brumberg, let me ask you about that, about this notion that women are doing it to themselves. Is it true, do you think, generally, and is it relatively recent?
Well, I think that's a complex issue. It's hard to pick that up from the kind of historical diary literature. But one of the things I'm always trying to get people to realize is the extent to which women do read each other's bodies, and they do it reflexively. You know, they don't even think about it, but they always notice if you've lost weight or if you've gained weight. And that's something that we could stop doing, or at least not teaching it to younger generations. There's also an anthropologist by the name of Mimi Dichter, I believe, who's analyzed the fat talk of adolescent girls. And what Brittany provides is yet another very powerful commentary on this kind of talk and how destructive it can be.
That's a clip from my conversation with historian Joan Jacobs Brumberg and humorist and blogger Brittany Gibbons. They joined me for a full-hour show about body image, and I'm here with a woman who produced that show, Anita Rao, who picked that segment as one of her favorites in 2015. This is an example of one of my favorite things to do here, the concept show, which we do occasionally on the state of things. We take an idea and then we explore it using different voices and different points of view throughout the hour. Tell us what it's like to put together that kind of a show.
So it is a challenge to put this kind of show together, but very fun. And the most important part for me as a producer when working on this kind of show is to make sure that the people that we have on it have really spunky personalities and are able to ground this really heady topic in very specific detail. So Jessamyn, for example, your conversation with her was so lively, and she was really able to use her own personal story to illustrate, you know, why fat shaming and why being a bigger woman in society today can be such a challenge. But the beauty of this kind of show is that it allows us to take one topic and look at it from so many different angles. So we had a personal narrative, we had a yoga practitioner, but we also had a psychologist, and we had a social historian, and we had a comedian who was able to sort of use Amy Schumer and use comedy and humor to shed light on some of the challenges of fat shaming and body image concerns. So I really like that we're able to balance all the varied perspectives, but really get sort of a 360 perspective on a complicated topic.
These shows are great to do. It's why I put my shoes on in the morning. These are my favorite shows because we can get at so much in just an hour. But and here's what a listener doesn't may not fully grasp is how difficult it is to get this thing right for producers. It's easy for me. Once you do all the work, I sit and have conversations with really smart people. Comes off sounding great, and I get a lot of credit. The hard part is, look, you've got to go into some depth, right? I mean, you don't want to just give us the quick CNN headline version of this very complicated topic. On the other hand, if you go into too much depth, we've lost it, right? Mm. So the balance is, can we get enough people with personal stories and then pull back enough to give it context, all doing this whole thing in an hour and make some sense of it? And that's a lot of hard work. And as I say, it sounds easy. And by the time I get all of the hard work you've done, it's a fun job for me. But I have to say, I admire you all for putting together these concept shows. And the looks on your faces when the concept comes up. Hey, I've got an idea. How about we look at zines and how they've... And then, well, now, how are we going to put that together? And you do. But let's move on. Next pick now. All of this, kind of a concept show as well. This one about immigration, and it focuses specifically on Latino immigrants in North Carolina.
Yeah, so we know that in the last two decades, international migration to North Carolina has increased dramatically, and more than half of the state's foreign-born population is Latino. So we know that the influx of new immigrants shapes our economy and the culture of our state, but we really wanted to take a deeper look at sort of who these immigrants are, what are their lives like, and why does this matter? So in the Triangle, there are hundreds of Latino women who earn their living as house cleaners, and many of them are undocumented and have been in the country for more than a decade. And there was a photography exhibit at Duke, actually, that documented the life histories of some of these women. And we decided to invite three of them to come on the show and talk about their experiences as a part of this bigger hour-long look at Latino immigrants in North Carolina.
All right. Well, here's a clip from my conversation with Marilou, Araceli, and Elizabeth. Elizabeth, let me ask you, have you ever been in a situation where you felt perhaps you were being treated unfairly, but you didn't really feel like you could talk to anybody about it, that you could go to anyone and get justice for the situation that happened to you in the home?
Not too long ago, we left the house because of that, because the women wanted to treat us like slaves. She told us, she pulled the things and she said, you cleaned there already. Something has been missing. Don't take that liquid. A lady really problemly, so we stopped going there. And it would just been only three times that we have been cleaning with her, but no. So we decided to just leave that house.
Araceli, you talked about the fact that there's no difference, you know, in terms of the intelligence of men and women. But do you find that when you work, when you go to work, that some people are treating you because you're maybe not speaking the same language as though, you know, you're not bright enough, you know, you're just not getting it?
What happens is there are people that don't even give you the opportunity if you can speak English well or not. They simply answer, "Ah, I can't talk to you because you're not going to understand me." They don't even take the time to find out if you really can understand or not. And that is very sad because they don't even give you a chance. And although this has happened to me, they don't know that I know how to speak English. I just don't say anything.
Simplemente no digo nada.
When you're there and you're just not saying anything, what's going through your mind? What would you like to say?
I would like to tell them I'm a human too. We can all have an opportunity in life, and they should ask if we speak the language. That is more than anything, and I think they would understand that.
Pienso que ellos lo entenderían.
People hearing this story might think to themselves, both what you and Elizabeth have just said about the kind of treatment you get from time to time. Well, why do you stay here? Why wouldn't you go back to Mexico?
I am
here basically because I believe that all of the Hispanic, Latino people, we're here for one reason, to make a better life and improve ourselves. If I had enough money to continue studying or the support in my country, I would not have made the trek. Unfortunately, that was the reason why I had to leave and why I'm here. To me, this has been quite a challenge. First, I was by myself. I now have a family. I have three children. One of them is already in college and another about to graduate. And the other one is in high school. And I'm very happy with myself because I have been able to guide them and give them a better future. Just because I didn't have the opportunity doesn't mean that they can have a better one. And I state that because if I can do it, anyone else can do it as well.
Y yo lo digo porque si yo he podido salir adelante, todos pueden.
What do you think are the biggest misconceptions that Americans have about you and your work in this country? Araceli?
Uno de los principales malos entendidos es que
one of the biggest misconceptions is that people in the U.S. think that we're here to take away their jobs and that we are a burden to them. One more thing, they need to help us and we don't provide help for them. I think that is the biggest error. We come here to work very hard. Many times we do the hardest work that they are not willing to do and they pay the least. And we still pay taxes in helping our children and helping the community. And there's very few people, Americans, that understand that.
Y es muy poca gente que reconoce eso.
That's a clip from my conversation with Marilu, Araceli, and Elizabeth, three women in Durham who work as house cleaners, part of our show on Latino immigrants in North Carolina, and one of producer Anita Rao's favorites in the year 2015. Tell us more about that one.
So there was a lot happening behind the scenes for this. First of all, I did pre-interviews in Spanish, which was a struggle because my Spanish was very rusty. But then as the conversation was happening, we had interpreters in another studio. You were hearing their interpretation on your headphones. They were hearing the interpretation of your questions in their headphones. And it was kind of crazy, but it turned out to be a really wonderful conversation. And I think to me, the value of listening to them tell their stories in their own words and hearing their emotion come through with their inflection and the specificity of how they share their own experience is really something that would have been lost if we had just had a complete voiceover, or if we hadn't brought them into the studio in the first place. So it was really an honor to be able to use their narratives to break down a lot of these misconceptions that I think a lot of us have about Latinos in our community.
It was a breakthrough for us. I still think we haven't done quite enough of it. We need to do more. But I think breaking through that barrier, that feeling that we really couldn't do it, it was going to be too complicated, was a big step for us. And hopefully there will be much, much more of this in 2016. State of Things producer Anita Rao with me today, reflecting on some of her favorite segments from 2015. And we'll continue that conversation just ahead. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, continuing our series of programs looking back at the last year, listening to some of the more memorable segments. And today's segments have been picked by producer Anita Rao. She is with me to tell us more. What do you have next?
So next, I'm going to talk about a segment from a full show that I produced about domestic violence. So it's obviously a huge topic, and there are many ways we could have approached the conversation. But it was important to me to find something in the conversation that would offer something new or something surprising. So we started the show talking with a woman who was actually the woman behind the hashtag Why I Stayed, which was something that was sort of all over after the number of NFL domestic violence incidents. So I found out that the woman who started that hashtag lived in North Carolina. So we started the show hearing from her and getting her story. And then we took a pretty surprising turn or twist in the conversation. We'd been talking a lot about programs that support survivors of domestic violence, but we decided to look at a program that works directly with offenders. There's a program in Wake County called DOSE, which stands for Developing Opportunities for a Safe Environment. And it's a program that tries to stop violence and hold batterers accountable. So we found one man who voluntarily put himself through the program after realizing that he was about to lose everything, lose his wife, lose his family. And his name is Mike. And he and his wife, Kimberly, joined us to share their story.
And Mike and Kimberly had been describing the fact that Mike's violence had been escalating. It all came to a head one night. And here he describes what he felt like the next day. Let's listen.
I woke up the next morning, you know, what in the world did I do? What's going to happen now? I can't believe this is happening. And, you know, within short order, probably within a day, I was in my therapist's office, you know, and I think it would be good at this time to mention, as Kimberly said, she didn't press charges. You don't need to be in handcuffs to realize you've got a problem, and you don't need to be in handcuffs to go to DOSE. Now, I'm not saying women should not call if they're abused. By all means, they should get law enforcement involved. My hope would be that there are men or women that can look at their situation and say, it hasn't gotten there yet, but it might, and seek that help out.
I need to add that it's not that it might happen. It will happen. It just sometimes takes a little bit longer. And so those first signs are trust your gut and trust your intuition and get out right away and get help.
And Mike, you talked about, you know, looking in the mirror and saying, look, I need help, and there are these programs out there. DOSE is a court-mandated program. There are a lot of people in there who have been ordered into the program. You're not. You chose to enter that program, right?
You're right. You're in there with a bunch of men, 90% of whom don't want to be there. The class runs 6 months, and there's a reason for that. You can break men down within that first month or two and make them realize, look, you're here. Get something out of this. And most men do.
Mike had slapped me in the face 2 years prior to that, and it shook me, and we dealt with it. But even that did not wake him up because he wasn't ready. He he just wasn't ready. And he did start seeing a therapist, but he kind of excused Mike's behavior because of his past or the way he was brought up. And with Joe's, they don't do that. She pretty much puts it to him. So.
Well, let me ask you that. What is the difference? Because you were in therapy. You were in therapy, I take it, for anger issues. And then there's Dose. What's the difference, Mike?
As Kimberly said, I wasn't ready before. This time I was. I was staring down the barrel of a wife, a second wife, who now I had abused, who left me. I was looking at a possible another divorce, my family being ripped apart again, and I just had this wake-up call. And this was very much a three-prong attack. There's no way for me to deny my faith in God and the factor that he has played in this. And Dose played a critical role in teaching me what real abuse is and arming me and educating me. My therapist played a key role in getting into deeper, more personal issues. God was the glue that directed it and held it all together. And at the center of that, I had to be willing to accept the consequences and put the time in. And there was a moment in the class, Kimberly alluded to Miss Johnette, the instructor. She's an amazing woman. She's patient, but she's firm. And so Kimberly and I had reconciled, and an argument came up. And it did not get violent, but it got very loud. And it was, that's it. And then Kimberly moved out, this time now for months. So I went to Dose that week, and I sat down, and I confessed this. And, you know, the men of the group were supportive. They said, look, man, you know, you got to pick yourself up. You know, just continue to work this. You can do it. You know, we've seen you make positive results, which was good to have men supporting you. And then Miss Johnette brought a chair over and sat down next to me. And she let me have it, not in a mean or angry way, but she basically laid it out and said, what is it going to take? You have the tools. You know them. I know you know them. You've applied them successfully, yet you refuse to completely commit. And after she sat there and really laid it out, I mean, I was broken. You know, I was just tears streaming out, and that was my wake-up call. That was the final nail in the coffin where I said, I have got to change.
You've given a pretty vivid description of how you snapped to attention in that moment. And now I'd like to get an idea of what it is that changed in your mind and heart. The difference between what you thought you were doing, you were showing up every day, you were very serious about this, you already realized much earlier the stakes that were involved, a second marriage, etc. So all of that had been pretty clear to you. And then you talked about this commitment. What's the difference between what you were feeling and the sense of commitment that you now felt?
In the past, anytime I tried to make change, it was try to make change for my marriage, try to make change for the woman I was with, trying to make change to have peace. That's not change. I had come to the realization I have got to change for myself. My wife might leave me. I may be alone for the rest of my life. There were so many what ifs, but I said, I have got to be in control of myself. I have got to do this for me. And I knew once that happened that my marriage, if it was going to remain, because it was an unknown at that time, my relationship with my children, other relationships would benefit, but it had to be for me.
That's a clip from my conversation with Mike and Kimberly, a couple who live in the Triangle, and they were talking about their relationship and Mike's violence. It was part of a show about domestic violence, and I'm here with producer Anita Rao, who's talking about some of her more memorable pieces from 2015. This gets to something we talk about a lot on The State of Things, my fear that important topics like domestic violence, we can never say we did that one. As long as it's a problem, then we will continue to talk about it. A thing that I worry about, and unfortunately the producers have heard it all too often around our conference table, is the fairy tale conversation, and that is the story that everybody knows. Mm. And it is in some way, no matter how horrific, comforted to hear the same kind of conversation over and over again on one public radio show to the next, to the next, to the next. And that's the fairy tale conversation, the thing I want to avoid and still leave conversations like this in the works because the work isn't done. And so the challenge for all of you is to come up with a conversation that's going to be pertinent, relevant, important, and not sound like everything you've already heard in public radio. What was the challenge in this one for you?
Yeah, so that was a big reason why I thought about telling a story from this perspective. I hadn't heard that before. I hadn't heard a couple who'd experienced that in their relationship sort of talk openly about that. But it was tricky. Before I even started this process, I had some reservations about sort of what are the ethics of giving voice to a former abuser and how do we make sure that this conversation comes through in a way that's respectful of, you know, all of the damage that he's done and the challenges of the situation. So I spent a ton of time finding the right guest. And that, I think, really was the key to making this segment work, was making sure that the person who we invited on to do this was really willing to be vulnerable and was very reflective and was self-aware, who could sort of take us into that moment, walk us through his process, but also say sort of, hey, you know, I wasn't in my right mind there. It really took me a lot of sort of bringing myself up and up again to realize that, you know, this wasn't a good thing to be doing. So finding the right guest, I think, is crucial to being able to create a segment.
Yeah, and I think just all, and I've watched it over and over again, all holding each other accountable to that standard and saying we're not going to settle for it if we can't get that. And we know we can't. I mean, that's the other thing, is that you never have to say, well, we're just not doing anything more on domestic violence. Yes, we are, and we will do it well. So I marvel at the fact and admire that you all persist and find the right level of conversation so that we can actually maintain our standards and not say, well, we've done it before and we give up and throw our hands up. So hats off to you and thank you once again. And now we can end the show on a slightly different note. Tell us about this last segment.
So this last segment comes from a Monday Meet that I produce. So Monday Meets are where we spend an hour with one individual talking about their life and their work and how those two things come together. And I love these segments. I love spending 3 hours on the phone with people and really getting to know their personal story. So I'd heard a lot about – I'm a big fan of the Avett Brothers, and I'd heard a lot about everyone else in the Avett Brothers aside from Joe Kwon, who's the cellist, who always sort of seemed like the most interesting member of the band to me. He plays the cello standing up. His hair is all over the place when he's performing. And I found out that he lived in Raleigh, so I decided to send him an email and see whether he'd be willing to come on the show. And he responded almost an hour after I wrote the email saying, like, yes, I love public radio. I'd love to be on. So we invited him on to do a Monday Meet with us.
I have to say, we all stood around your desk every time you were talking to Joe Kwon because you are such a fan. I mean, you were giddy. You're like putting the phone down saying, oh, my God, he just said, Seth, you can put that down over there. He just said that. I heard him. He was such a fan. It was amazing to me. But anyway, apparently you enjoyed it.
I did enjoy it.
And it turns out it was a great segment. So why don't we listen right now to this segment that we did when we met Joe Kwon.
Okay, yeah. So here he is talking about the first time that he performed live with the Avett Brothers. He had recorded an album with them. But had never gone up on stage with the whole crew.
This is a band that's well known for its high energy antics on stage. Yeah. And there you are on stage, sitting in your little chair with your cello.
Not even a chair. I was sitting on Scott's amp because that's what was available. Uh-huh. I sat for 20 seconds probably. And the guys are just, they're jumping all over the place. They're going wild. And I'm playing like a cellist, sitting uh-huh. down with no energy. And I stood up and that was it. Yeah. Some chiropractor out there is going to make millions off of me one day because of that one decision.
What did that do, though? I mean, there's a reason cellists sit. It's nice to have. It's big. It's not a fiddle. You can't tuck it under your chin. So when you dance with that thing, it does seem to wiggle a bit and to try to control it and play. How was your playing that? It's got to be hard to do.
My playing wasn't good to start with, so this only made it worse. Yeah. It was something that I was taught a long time ago at a summer camp at Interlochen. I had a friend, fellow cellist, who is an amazing cellist, and she's now still doing some great work. She was walking down the little alleyway at Interlochen with the cello tucked behind her head and playing like her part in a quartet she was working on. It's like, oh yeah, that's really cool, you know? And in the back of my head, it was just tucked for years and years and years. And that was like the moment when I was playing with the Avids. I was like, I remember that time that Clarice Jensen put that cello behind her neck and she walked around with it.
Trudging through the snow at Interlaken. Yeah. So now you've played this New Year's, you've done a record. There's a one-off, or I guess two, New Year's Eve gigs, and now you're back to Spanky's, right? How
Absolutely.
You feeling?
Still riding that high for a while. Yeah. Spanky's had notoriously bad Tuesday night bar shifts, and this is kind of the darkest point in my young life at that point, and it was a Tuesday terrible bartending shift. I probably made $20. I was in a bad place mentally because I, was questioning my decision to go back down this road of playing music. Mm. And I walked into the parking deck and got to my car, and the parking deck costs $6 to park. So there goes my paycheck, $20. I just sat there in my car, and just kind of put my head down and was just like, what is going on? I can't believe that this is where I'm going to, the direction I'm going. And at that time, we weren't allowed to use our cell phones, So I clicked my cell phone on, my little Nokia, tiny little, phone. Nothing, doesn't say anything. It just says, you have 4 voice messages. And I remember 4 voice messages for some reason. And I listened to the first voice message, and it was Bob. And he said, Joe, we really liked having you at New Year's, and we're looking for someone to help us out on the road. And we would love it if you would come out and tour with us. And that was it. Worst night ever turned to life-changing event.
All right, that was our Monday Mead with Joe Kwan, produced by Anita Rao, who was a major fan. So the question is, with all that buildup, it was great as far as we were concerned. But what about you? Meet your expectations?
It did. I'd spent 3 hours with him on the phone, as you described. And so there was a lot left on the table, but that's sort of always the case in this show. And I loved that we were able to share a lot of his music and have him reflect on the process of playing with a band. And everyone got to see me geek out. So
it was a lot of fun.
It was all worth it.
And we'll do it all again next year. Thank you so much for all your hard work, Anita.
Thanks, Frank.
Anita Rao, producer of The State of Things. You can find a link to all the conversations we talked about today at stateofthings.org. Our program is produced, in addition to Anita Rao, by Laura Lee, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director with help from Al Wadarski. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stay Show.